Thanks for coming to my talk. Today I will present joint work that I did with my supervisor, Barbara Terhal. And maybe let me just start off with enumerating some properties which might be desirable for quantum codes with respect to physical implementation. So certainly we want that our codes are low-density parity check codes, or LDPC codes. And what that means is that parity checks involve only order one number of qubits. And this is certainly desirable because many particle interactions are very hard to realize in the lab. Certainly, we want a high threshold. That means that logical errors are exponentially suppressed as long as the physical error rate is below the threshold. Also, we want an efficient decoder. And we want a low overhead. And by that I mean that we only need, we want to maximize the number of logical qubits that we get for investing physical qubits, just because making physical qubits is very costly. So, and today I will talk about families of codes which are derived from hyperbolic surfaces, which have all these above qualities. So first of all, let me just briefly go through something like a recipe, which turns a tiled surface, 2D surface, into an LDPC code. I just wanted to remark that this this recipe is actually more general than the way I will present it. So it actually works for any dimensional manifolds, but we will stick to the 2D case. And it works the following way. So we take we assign or we define three Z2 vector spaces, which I will call C0, C1, and C2, and which have dimensionality given by the number of vertices, edges, and faces of the tiled surface. And you can think of the elements of these vector spaces simply as collections of these elements. So if we have an entry 0, it means this element is not in the set or in the collection. And if we have an entry 1, then it is. Okay, and now we can use this notion of these vector spaces to define linear operators, which encode the lattice topology. Namely, these are the boundary operator, which maps from dimension I to one dimension lower, and the co-boundary operator, which maps the other way around, so we go one dimension up. And just to get an intuitive feeling of what this means, or how they're defined. So here we have some collection of faces. So this would be an element of C2. And we can apply the two boundary operator to this. And what it does is it takes the collection of edges, which are incident to each of these faces, and adds the modulo 2, so that elements in the bulk will cancel out. And we really get the boundary of this region. So it does what you intuitively would expect it to do. And similarly, the co-boundary operator takes, for example, one vertex, and it assigns the collection of edges which are incident to this one vertex. OK, and now we can define a very important notion. So we call some collection of edges closed if when we apply the one boundary operator to it, we get 0. So it means that this collection of edges doesn't have any endpoints. And now we can use this to define two subspaces, one called cycles. These are in the kernel of the one boundary operator. So these are all closed loops, or collections of closed loops, to be more precise. And we can define boundaries, which are all the closed loops that we get from applying the two boundary operator, so they are like the area surrounding, they are like the perimeter surrounding some area. And note that Z1 might encompass more than just B1, so there might be closed loops which are not contractible or surrounding an area, but which kind of go around the whole surface. And similarly, we can define notions called co-cycles and co-boundaries using the co-boundary operator. OK, so now the recipe works as follows. So we take a tiled closed surface and we identify edges with qubits. So we put qubits on the edges. We compute the boundary and the co-boundary group. And then we define a stabilizer CSS code just by taking the Z representatives of the boundaries and the X representatives of the co-boundaries, meaning that if I have a vector in B1, then I will it will act as Z on all the elements which are 1 in this vector. Okay, and it's important to note that if we look at the orthogonal complement of B1, which will be all the elements commuting with Z, then this gives us exactly this is exactly given by the co-cycles, which encompass the co-boundaries. So this is all elements of the stabilizer group will certainly commute, which is desirable. The normalizer of the stabilizer group will encompass all closed loops. So the ones which are non-trivial are exactly the non-trivial loops. Okay, so now the general idea for constructing codes is the following. So we want a family of codes with growing distance. This, using the recipe, can be reformulated in the search for families of tiled surfaces, where the shortest non-trivial loop grows with letter size. And one way to do this is if we take some infinite tiling of the plane, then we kind of successively wrap up patches of increasing size. And I will later make this more more precise. Okay, just as a small example that everybody knows. So of course, a toroid code is a homological code where we just tie R2 by squares, square tiling of R2, and after L steps in X and Y direction, we kind of wrap up the whole surface and get a torus. And of course, we know that we only encode two qubits corresponding to the two non-trivial loops. So the question is, can we do better than just two? And the answer is, in fact, no. So for Euclidean tilings, if we do this construction, we will always end up with a torus. Maybe we need to introduce curvature to get something better. And in fact, this is the case. So there's the so-called Gauss-Bonnet theorem, which states that the integrated curvature is connected to the topology. And more concretely, if we integrate the Gaussian curvature over the area of the whole surface, then this is proportional to 2 times the genus, which is the number of non-contractible loops. So this is really the number of handles that the surface will have. If we just plug in k equals to minus 1, so we have a surface where the curvature is minus 1 at every point, then we really get that that the number of non-contractible loops is directly proportional to the area of the surface. And the area of the surface, once we put this into our machinery, will be the number of, or will be proportional to the number of qubits. This idea is not new, so the best of my knowledge, this was first done by Friedman and Meyer. Okay. So now first, to get some intuitive understanding how curved spaces look like, I would want to introduce a hyperbolic plane. So this is an infinite plane of negative curvature, which means that at every point, it kind of looks like a saddle. And one can visualize this infinite space by using the Poincaré disk model. And what this does is it maps the whole infinite space into a unit disk. So this obviously highly distorts length scales. So here at the boundary, we would have infinity. But it preserves angles, which is nice. And if we look at geodesics, so geodesics are given by arcs, which go through the disk and intersect the boundary in a right angle. And if we construct a triangle in this way, that we just take three geodesics, then you can kind of convince yourself that we can get triangles with where the angle sum is any number smaller than pi. Yeah? So we have a lot of freedom of kind of constructing triangles. So compared to the Euclidean space, we always need that the angle sum will be pi. Yeah, and again, the idea is wrapping up subregions of the hyperbolic plane to obtain hyperbolic surfaces. Okay, and we kind of restrict ourselves to a certain type of tiling, which is very symmetric. These are called regular tilings, which look the same at every vertex and edge and face. And due to the symmetry, we can characterize them by only two numbers, R and S. So R means, R determines the number of sides that a face or bucket has. So all the faces are argons. And S tells us how many argons are incident to one vertex. Yeah, using this yeah, triangle, like the angle sum of triangles, we can see that that this determines the geometry. So this inequality or equality. So if it's larger than like 1 over r plus 1 over s is larger than 1/2, then we certainly are on a sphere. And we can see that there are 5 spherical tilings, which are exactly the Platonic solids. If it's equal to 1/2, which means that the angle sum has to be pi, then we see that there are actually only 3 solutions to this, which are the square tiling and hexagonal tiling and its dual. But for hyperbolic tilings, we have a lot more freedom. So there are actually, in fact, infinitely many hyperbolic tilings, hyperbolic regular tilings. Okay. So knowing this and using our machinery, we can define quantum codes from surfaces which are tiled by an RS tiling. And we see that the rate of these will, or the asymptotic rate of these will depend only on R and S. The larger we choose R and S, so the larger we choose the stabilizer weight, the higher the rate of the code will be. So we kind of get rewarded. Okay, so now I want to maybe briefly say how one can construct these tiled surfaces. So what we do is we look at the symmetry group of the tiling, of the full hyperbolic space. So this group is generated by two elements, rho and sigma, where you can think of rho as a rotation around a face and sigma as a rotation around a vertex. So that means that these two are subject to these constraints. So certainly if we kind of rotate an argon r times, we have to go back to the identity. So we do nothing. And as I said, the idea is we take translations out of the symmetry group, and we use these translations to wrap up the surface. So I have a small example here, which is a 5-4 tiling, which is the smallest the hyperbolic tiling with the smallest R and S. And this gives us a code of asymptotic rate 1 over 10. So if we invest 10 physical qubits, we will get one protected logical qubit. So here are some small examples. The smallest one is with 80 edges, so 80 qubits, which gives us 10 logical qubits. And this is the translation which wraps the surface up. So maybe we can just go through the example. So if we apply sigma, let's say to this edge, kind of look at what happens to this edge. Then sigma will rotate this edge here. Then we apply an inverse rho rotation, so we end up here. So sigma rho inverse actually translates this edge to this edge. If we do this 4 times, then we go end up 1, 2, 3, 4, end up here. And then wrapping up means we add in a relation which maps this to the identity. And this we do for we do this for the normal closure of the group generated by this. So this actually is also true for all the other edges. So it kind of wraps up all at once. Yeah, and for increased translations, we get larger surfaces, which encode more qubits, and which have a higher weight. Okay, and just wanted to note that this looks very easy here, but it's actually a very complicated combinatorial task to find these normal subgroups of the symmetry group. Okay, so we know we have a finite rate. So what about the distance?
Is the group for the general hyperbolic tiling generated in exactly the same way with these two neighboring generators?
Yes, in fact, actually every two-dimensional tiling is, you mean general in the sense that...
any R and S.
Yes, yes. So, well, I mean, this is not the full symmetry group, so I took out the reflections, just because I only wanted to orientable surfaces. So one can actually gain more if we take three generators, and which are the reflections around the symmetry axis of the faces. Okay, just as a comment.
You mean you're only taking subgroups of that
group? Yes, right.
And this is a hard combinatorial problem, but one which has been solved, or one which
no, solved, actually. So? Well, actually, factoring is a subset of this. So finding if I just have a cyclic group and then kind of trying to find normal subgroup of this, it is factoring. So this is actually a hard problem, but it's only at only when we really want to make the code we have to invest this. I will later come to some examples so I can kind of generate. Examples easily up to maybe 2,000 qubits on a single core.
How does it scale the number of qubits? I mean, you can ask how hard does it get?
Okay, yeah, I don't know. I only have like
okay, we just have number
yeah.
One
number of qubits. Right. As I said, we only have to do this once. Let us find a new way of design the architecture. Right. Okay. Right, so we have a finite rate. So the question is now, what is about the distance? And there's a simple argument, or intuitive argument, that this can only grow logarithmically. So if we take some disk in the hyperbolic space, then we know that the area will grow exponentially in the radius. And actually, this was made more precise by Delfosse in a more general setting. So actually, for any 2D homological code, derived from a closed surface, the parameters of the code are subject to this bound. And you see, if I plug in a finite rate code, then the distance has to be logarithmic. OK, so this is the bad news. The good news is that actually these tilings which saturate this bound do exist. This is a result due to Ziran. And what it says is simply, we can find such a family, and the distance will be lower bounded by a logarithm to a base C, which depends on R and S. And this base, the C, will go to infinity for increased R and S. So if we want to have a higher rate, then this bound will become worse and worse.
So that corresponds to this same as this trade-off.
No, I mean it's still logarithmic. It's just about this constant.
Yeah, but I mean there is a relation of k with R and S. You're saying the theorem around this also having.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. So it's a.
Is it saturating that bound or? This constant C of R and S. Well.
No. So this constant actually is very. I mean, this is just an analytic result. This constant is actually very bad.
Right, but it is a function of R and S, yeah. Right? He gives it as a function.
Yes, right. It kind of goes like x to the x.
It's very. Doesn't say anything about k.
Yes.
No, but there's a k, but there's a relation of k and n that you've given before.
Yes, right.
Depending on R and S. Yeah. So you can compare those relations.
Sure. But I mean, so.
Probably this is just a bound.
This is just a bound, and the bound is quite bad. So, So in this 2000 paper, they prove that it's actually kind of scales like R times S to the R times S. And there are actually better bounds which use some functions of number theory, which are slightly better, but they are still like way off. For all practical purposes, this bound is not very useful. Okay. So distance is not everything, but that I mean that the Tori code is especially interesting because it has a very high threshold. So if we have independent XZ errors and we have perfect syndrome measurement, then the threshold is around 10%. And we have an efficient decoder, which is minimum weight perfect matching, which just pairs up anions in minimizing the distance between them. This is, in fact, an algorithm which works for all 2D homological codes, so we can just use them for our codes. So now the question is whether we actually have a threshold. And there's a theorem due to Dumas, which says that if we have a homological code, even if the distance is only lower bounded by a logarithm, then we will have a threshold, which might still be quite bad. So we did some numerics.
So I was unclear about that theorem there. So when you talk about the threshold up here, you give a couple of promises about noise. So you said like perfect syndrome measurements.
Yes.
You said only X and Z errors. Are there similar caveats to that
theorem? Oh, no. Actually, this theorem also holds for noisy syndrome measurement.
But are there any restrictions at all in the form of noise?
Oh, no. Well, actually, it works for any polychannel. Polychannel noise and erasure. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I mean the ideas are pretty general, but I don't think you can look at their, because they haven't really looked at more correlated noises.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
All right. Right, and just to see whether we actually get something, some threshold, we did some numerical analysis. And the idea is as follows. So I will only explain for Z errors, but the X errors are just dual. So we apply some errors on the edges. The syndrome is simply given by the boundary of this collection of edges. We perform minimum weight perfect matching. And then to see whether we apply the logical, we check whether the error plus the correction is in the image of the two boundary operator. If it is, it's just a stabilizer. If it's not, it's some, it includes some non-trivial loop. And we say that the correction has failed if a logical on any encoded qubit was applied. OK. And the result looks as follows. So we did this for codes starting at n equals 60 up to n equals 1280. Sorry, this is for the 5-4 tiling, so the one with the smallest stabilizer checks. So we encode roughly 1/10. So the rate is roughly 1/10. And
what range of distances does that set of codes cover?
Oh, that I don't know. So it's kind of hard to compute numerically. And analytically, I only have a bound, and the bound tells me more or less nothing.
Not a very big range of distances, I guess.
Not very big, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. That's, you can kind of you can look at the translations. So I have a program which kind of gives me out the relations and the translations which I use to compactify, and you can kind of tell. Oh yeah, these kind of grow. So they are like these all these rotations. So you can kind of get a feeling. So it does grow, but.
But you have done some numerics, but for smaller.
For very small.
You just determine the distance.
Right. I determine the distance, and there it's very hard to tell. Like, even if I take higher weight stabilizers, it's hard to make out a difference between the different different codes. Yeah. All right. So these are the results for the 5-4 tiling. These are. A bit inconclusive in that the curves don't intersect in a single point. So I mean, the one with 60 qubits is off due to finite size effects, I guess. But here it's really a bit hard to tell where the threshold is. Nonetheless, it's very suggestive because it kind of tends to approximate a step function. So we say that this kind of suggests a threshold around 2%, but take this with a grain of salt.
So what are the logical error rates? I mean, I can see obviously on the big scale, but in the
Oh, this is like below between I think 0.5% and 2%. This one.
The bottom line and the upper line of the box.
You mean here?
The vertical axis, the range of the vertical axis of that lower.
Oh, right. Okay. Sorry. Maybe I should have included this. So here we have one. How to tell? I would say. Okay. I can only.
You can see from the plot, right?
Yeah.
Well, kind of roughly, but what I can tell from that is how it compares to the physical error rates in that range.
So, like, where's the logical error rate?
Yeah. Is it? I mean, it, yeah. are the logical error rates higher or lower than physical error rates?
Oh, okay.
Where's the crossover?
So all right. I don't know. Okay, maybe we can look later at the full plot and then we can see. The point that I wanted to make is kind of like that they will also eventually cross around each other. So that for a larger number of physical qubits, we kind of stay longer in a protected regime. And another. Another analysis one can make is to see the overhead, meaning that we kind of compare error protecting capabilities versus the encoding rate. So we fix some logical error rate of 0.999, and we say that we want to protect all logical qubits with this probability. And then we just plot the results for different families of codes. And we see that the Tori code performs actually quite well. But then the next best is the hyperbolic code 5.4. And then for higher and higher stabilizer weight, we get less and less protection, although we get a higher and higher rate.
Sorry, I don't understand what's the physical error rate
here? The physical error is plotted here. This is a physical error rate. So this is a physical error rate up to which the logical error rate will be,
So it's kind of a practical estimate of how useful these codes may be.
Yeah.
First, that logical error rate is not that low yet.
Right, yes. That's true. Okay. So, if you would go to an experimentalist, then certainly he would say that it's good to have LDPC codes, but it would be better if this whole layout would be planar. And we know that this can be done for the Tori code. This is called the surface code. And you can imagine the surface code getting the surface code from the Tori code by taking a loop around the lattice and cutting it open, and then taking a loop around the dual lattice and cutting that open, and obtaining the surface code in this way. And some naive idea would be to take the hyperbolic surface, which is some multi-handle torus, just cutting open the handles. But there's an obvious problem. We know that we have a finite rate and we have a non-vanishing distance. So just plugging this in would give us more physical qubits than we actually have. So if we do this procedure, we lose the finite rate. We give some argument that if we have a planar code, then there's a bound of k times d upper bounded by some constant times n, which is still worse, like a weaker bound than the Bravi-Poulin-Terhal bound.
Yeah, of course, this is a fairly specific bound for this homological construction. It's not very general.
Yes. Okay. But nonetheless, we construct a small example. Let's go very quickly through the. We do this. So in this case, we take the 5-5 tiling. So we start with 5 pentagons incident to 1 vertex. This is called level 1. And then we reflect around the boundaries to get level 2. And we can kind of iterate this process to get a larger and larger patch. But we stop here just because it's very hard to draw. What we do then is we end up with 60 edges at the boundary, and we divide them up into 10 regions because we later want to encode 4 logical qubits. these two regions will alternatingly give us rough and smooth boundaries, and we create the rough boundaries by removing qubits and X stabilizers in every second region. So what we end up with is a planar 65-4-4 code, which has logical Z weight of 4, logical X weight of 5. And if we compare this to the most efficient use of the surface code, which is due to Horseman and all, where they take the surface code and they kind of chop off parts of the lattice, then to obtain 4 logical qubits with distance 4 or 5 would require 64 or 100 qubits. So we kind of get a slight advantage using the hyperbolic lattice.
Yeah, but this construction doesn't scale well. At least at a base is bounded in your case.
Yes.
Right. But it may even be worse. It's not clear that it changes.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and just to wrap up this talk, so we have kind of seen how we can construct hyperbolic codes, which have distance scaling as log n, but a finite rate and low stabilizer check, low weight stabilizer checks. There's a the trade-off between distance and encoding rate is way more favorable compared to the toric and the surface code. Right, and for all practical purposes, we certainly want the stabilizer weight to be as low as possible, and hence the most effective code would be the 5-4 code with an asymptotic rate of 1/10. And we gave some partial evidence that it has a logical error rate, a threshold around 2%. Okay. We all. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
So you said at the beginning that that these codes had exponential error suppression, but that's not actually correct, right? I mean, so can you go back to
the
other
slides?
Yeah, right. I think that.
Where?
Very, very early slide, maybe the first one.
Yeah, the second.
Oh, okay. So, okay, sure. Okay. Yes.
I mean, because with log distance only polynomial.
Yeah, sure.
And so what does that mean in practice? I mean, you looked at this 0.999 cutoff.
Yes.
Suppose you add another 9. What does that
mean? Oh, well. Okay, that's kind of hard to tell because I couldn't do it numerically. So these were, I mean, these are still partial results. I mean, I hope I can kind of improve. But doing the error correction is kind of costly because I don't have a very simple distance function as for the toric code. So I really have to kind of find the distance in the graph that makes it very costly to do these numerics. So that would be definitely interesting to see.
And you have to do the full.
Yes.
No.
It's just Blossom.
Yeah, but I mean, you could do. Of course, the question is, if you want to analyze what this logical error rate scales, okay, maybe you get a worse threshold if you use another decoder, but you could maybe extract information about, you know, how this logical error rate scales. If it's more efficient decoder.
But,
I mean, I think it's a separate study.
But like these decoders that Ravi and
the RG decoder.
You ran that also in the beginning, right?
In the very beginning, but
Do they work in this direction?
They do work. But they give worse results. I didn't quite.
But do you remember that they do faster or is it so?
I think they were faster, but just for generating these plots, and just because I didn't want to go like too high too high of number of Markov repetitions, I kind of stopped doing that.
The other thing, which is a pity, that you cannot, it's hard to get, because there's also likely to be a threshold. You know, you're looking at the threshold, will any of the qubits fail? right? This mm-hmm, you're saying, but you can also say, well, it's a threshold that they're all, but you cannot,
that's
they all fail, that there may be a different point.
I mean, there's symmetry, right? So each, probably all the logical qubits are going to be the same, unless there's some,
they mean some the
loops that are.
No, there's not necessarily the same distance, right? You have, well, at least close, they're close.
They're close, yes.
But you have some numerics where you say.
Yes, right, for some small examples, but I'm not sure like how.
But you.
Is there an upper bound on the largest non contractible loop size or something?
Yes, right. Yeah.
Which is also a thing like what?
Yes.
What? I mean, there must be non contractible loops that go around many times.
Well, I mean, they go like, I mean, it's Z2, so they would kind of, they would kind of pencil out. Yeah, so they might be, they're collections of non-contractible loops, so.
There's, the shortest equivalent of the non-contractible loop, yes. That's what I was trying.
Right, more questions? Okay, then thank you.